on this episode of Still Loading. I swear, if I have to listen to Navi say, "Hey, listen, one more fucking time," I'm gonna... Hey guys, it's Josh, and welcome back to a new episode of Still Loading. Thank you all for tuning in and listening and, you know, doing whatever. Just thank you for joining me on this. And I'm really excited for this week's episode. If you couldn't tell by the title, this week's episode is The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And the reason I'm covering this, as well as some of my other fellow podcasters on the Podbeard Network, shout out, Podbeard Network, new member. Super excited. Anyway, we'll get back to that. But the reason we're covering it, though, is because it is the 20th anniversary of the game's release. The game was originally released on November 21st in 1998 in Japan, and then later on in North America, I believe on November 23rd. So it's a perfect time to talk about this incredible legendary game, and I figured I should dive right into it. But before we go into the game, I just wanted to give a couple quick shout-outs. Normally I do the shout-outs at the end, but as I mentioned slightly before, I am now a member of the Podbeard Network, and I could not be happier. My friend TJ is the owner and operator of the network. He runs the podcast Two Guys in a Game, The Hotter Show, as well as being on the podcast Mics and Beers. And seriously, if you have not listened to them after all my shout outs at the end of the episodes, definitely go check them out. They're a great podcast, or they're all great podcasts, excuse me. And as well as those podcasts, there's also the Twitch streamer Darkrunner. Go check him out, as well as Creeper Sleep, which is another, they're not, Creeper Sleep is not a Twitch streamer, but it's another podcast. Hasn't posted in a while, but it's kind of like a, you know, scary true crime type of style podcast. And definitely go give that a listen too. And also the Honestly Lazy Show on YouTube. Those are all the members of the Podbeard Network, so go check them all out. So let's dive right into this. So to start, the game had a 2.5 year development cycle. And there's a lot of interesting stuff I dug up in researching for this. So for those who are really interested in video game history like I am, I pulled a lot of the stuff that I found the most interesting out of these. But if you go to if you look up Iwata Asks on, you know, just do a Google search for it, you'll find a lot of this information is like on there through their Ocarina of Time 3DS remake. Iwata, rest in peace while he was still alive, did an interviews with a lot of the original staff for Ocarina of Time, because they were, you know, they were remaking it for the 3DS back in like 2010, 2011, whatever year that remake came out in. So I think it actually might have been 2010, because I think it was supposed to be, or maybe 2011. It was 2011, because it was all for like the 25th anniversary of Legend of Zelda. So in any case, definitely go check that out. I got a lot of this information from there, and it's great. There's so much more that I don't even think I'd really have time to go into. So I just wanted to give that a quick shout out, but let's dive into it. So Ocarina of Time goes without saying as being one of the most prolific, significant games of all time. And while it does have some flaws, I know the internet may crucify me for that. While it does have some flaws, it is still a very, very good game. I popped my copy in recently and kind of replayed part of it. Just went through the first dungeon just for old time's sake. And still, the controls still feel good. It's still fun. It's still easy for me to use, even all these years later. And while certain aspects may not hold up, overall, I still think this game is really good. And shocker, so does the rest of the internet. But I just wanted to, you know, kind of give, like, start off with that. Just, I still love this game. It's still very important to me. It's one of the seminal parts of my childhood. And I'll kind of go into the whole waxing nostalgia towards the end of the episode. But I really just wanted to, I love talking about this game. So let's dive into it. The plot of the game focuses around you learn later he's a Hylian, but spoiler alert. In fact, spoilers for all this. If anyone has not played Ocarina of Time, what are you doing listening to this? Go play the game, come back, pause this, all right, pause it for, you know, the 10, 12 hours, however long, I don't even know how long the game takes to beat anymore, but go pause this right now. Go beat the game. I'll wait. Come on. You can do it. Yep. Slash there. Yep. And when you're done, come unpause it. Come on back here. So, all right. So, yeah. The story of the game revolves around the main character of Link, the hero of Hyrule, or the hero of time. And basically what happened, the whole premise of the game is that the evil dark wizard Ganon, which in this game is named Ganondorf, is trying to kind of corrupt the kingdom of Hyrule and take command of the Triforce himself. And the Triforce, explained expertly in this game, is, you know, a mythical, like, powerful object that was created by three goddesses at the beginning of time, at the beginning of the creation of the of Hyrule, of the world. And he wants to take power, he wants to take it so he can become all powerful. And Link has to stop him. And so he understand the he gets put on this quest by the Great Dooku Tree. Now, there's a lot to this story. I'm going to be kind of skimming through the bits and pieces of it. I don't feel it's necessary to explain the whole story in detail. So he gets put on this quest by the Great Dooku Tree, who is kind of like the guardian spirit of the town he grew up in, which is Kokiri Forest, excuse me. And he has to go out and save the world. To do so, he needs to obtain three different gems from various places around Hyrule, which is the kingdom, for those who don't know, the kingdom of Hyrule, the world of Zelda. And he has to obtain three gems to unlock the door to the Triforce, unlock that door, which is in the Temple of Time in Hyrule Castle in the center of the world. And so Link goes around, gets all the gems. I know I'm really simplifying this for those who have already played this, but not worth going into all these details, especially for those who already know it. So Link gets the three gems, goes to the Temple of Time, opens the door, only to find that Ganondorf was waiting for him the whole time. And Link gets ambushed, and he gets knocked out, and 7 years pass, and now he's an adult. And Ganondorf has taken over Hyrule, and it's up to Link to rescue the seven sages, which they kind of unveil right there at that point for you, the player. You have to rescue the seven sages and obtain their medallions in order to seal Ganon away for good and take the Triforce back. And of course, you don't know where Princess Zelda is, the namesake of the game. Of the game series, and you have to, you know, explore your way around Hyrule and rescue the world, or save the world. So, in a very brief nutshell, that is the game. I don't even know if I did a good job explaining that, but it's a really fun game, and the storyline feels so epic. The story is very simple, but the game feels so incredibly epic. Like, you feel like you're on this grand adventure the entire time. And you just every minute you're on it, you just want to know what happens next, especially for the first time playing it. And the game really builds this sense of suspense very well, because you don't really know what's going to happen, especially, like I said, spoilers already, but the plot twist in the middle where Ganon's waiting for you and you see the world in ruin because you didn't see it coming. You could not stop him because you're only a child. You had to wait 7 years in order to wake up and become the hero of time that can stop Ganondorf. It's a very epic feeling game. And the game designers did some cool stuff with this time jump mechanic, because you can go back to being a young Link, and you find this out later on in the game, to being young Link. You can go back to the Temple of Time, put this Master Sword back in the pedestal. Didn't even talk about the Master Sword, but that's how you're supposed to unlock the Triforce with the Master Sword. And when Link pulls it out, that's when Ganondorf steps in, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so you can put the Master Sword back in, and Link will revert to his child timeline. And when he pulls the sword back out, it fast forwards him 7 years in the future. And if I'm correct, I believe the developer said young Link is supposed to be around 9 years old, and adult Link is supposed to be about 16, hence the 7 years. So what's interesting, though, that's the story of the game. What's interesting, though, is that the game wasn't originally going to even have an young and an old Link. Based off the research I did through the, you know, Iwata Asks and whatnot, or through the Iwata Asks article, excuse me, they really did not. They just originally pictured it as just an adult Link game, and because they originally just pictured it as adult Link, there was no young Link originally, and the reason it changed is because Miyamoto wanted it to. He saw the direction, the art direction the game was going in, and while he did like Adult Link, he thought it was quote unquote too cool for Nintendo. Nintendo was family friendly and cute, but he also didn't want to lose that cool aspect that would draw other people, you know, a different demographic in. So he kind of forced their hand midway through the development. It wasn't even like this was early on. They had already developed a lot of the game, and Miyamoto's like, "No, I want young Link. Do it." And much to their chagrin, to the team's chagrin, they had to do it. And it caused a lot of turmoil in the development team. They were constantly arguing about how, in terms of story, like, how would this work? Like, how can we add in a young Link to this adult Link storyline that had not, didn't account for it in the slightest? And overall, I think they did a pretty damn good job, considering it was kind of like halfway through the development and they really had to work around it, to work the story around to make it work, to make that mechanic work. So there's a lot of interesting stuff. And speaking of things that didn't make it into the game, there's a lot of interesting things that were part of the development team initially, but never really came to fruition, excuse me. And one of the ones I found that was most interesting was that Miyamoto first pictured the game taking place entirely in Ganon's castle. The player would explore different rooms, and that would take them to different worlds, and which is kind of similar to Super Mario 64. The reason this was the original idea, Miyamoto's original idea, was because since they didn't know what the technical limitations they had were, this is all new. This was uncharted territory. Just like Super Mario 64, this was a whole new type of game that they were trying to make in a 3D environment. Moving 2D to 3D is really, it's really fucking hard. It's so difficult to, from a design standpoint, it's really hard. Now, granted, we've had, you know, 20 some odd years of 3D development, so it's a little bit different. You have, you know, precedents to look back on. You can look back on Ocarina of Time. You can look back on Mario 64 to be like, I want a game like that. That felt good. I liked those controls. But when Nintendo was making it, they didn't have any of that. So they would have to really come up with stuff from scratch. And with that in mind, Miyamoto had no idea how big the scale of the game could be. And he didn't know if, you know, you would have a whole world like having Hyrule Field and the Kokiri Forest and the Lost Woods and, you know, I keep wanting to say Mount Doom, but it's not Mount Doom. But, you know, Zora Kingdom, I can't remember the name of the fucking mountain. Oh, this is going to bother me. That is awful. How do I not? It's where the Gorons live. I want to say it's like Mount Hylia, but no, that, I don't think that is. Well, anyway, I'll look it up while I'm talking, and we'll just go from there. But no, so he originally wanted it to be just in Ganon's castle, or Ganondorf's castle, excuse me. Death Mountain, that's what it was. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut that off. Death Mountain is the name of the mountain. I just could not think of it. No, so yeah, he wanted it to originally all take place inside of Ganon's castle, or Ganondorf's castle. And to me, I'm glad he didn't stay with that, because it wouldn't have been as much fun, it wouldn't have felt as epic, and it would have felt too similar to Mario 64. It just would have been Zelda 64 instead of Ocarina of Time, if that makes sense. It would have felt just like, let's reskin Mario with Zelda and just, you know, change to combat. But thankfully they didn't. And another interesting thing that that they had originally planned was Ocarina of Time was going to be in first person, believe it or not. Miyamoto originally pictured it in not like an FPS, but I guess when you add a bow in, it kind of was like an FPS. But yeah, so Miyamoto originally thought about having it in first person, but thankfully when they tried to implement it, in terms of design, I don't even mean technical limitations. I mean, in terms of visual design, it just didn't look appealing to him. So thankfully he brought it back to the third person view that we all know and love. Like, seriously, can you, any of you guys imagine Zelda in first person, like permanently? I know you have like some first person viewpoints in the series where you can, you know, shoot the bow, shoot the hook shot, you know, things like that, shoot the slingshot, but that's only, you know, temporary. You don't actually have to play the entire game in first person. I mean, seriously, if anyone would like that, I'd honestly like to hear why. Like, not in a sarcastic or like judgmental kind of way, more just curiosity, like how do you think it could work? And anyway, so they didn't do it, thank God. Another thing that they didn't have originally was the automatic jumping. Originally, they wanted to have it jump on command like Mario does, you know, you hit A to jump. And Miyamoto decided against it because it was really, based on the Iwata Ask interview, it was really hard to understand why exactly he didn't want it in the game, but he ended up not wanting it in the game. He wanted the automatic jumping, I guess. If you think about it, it does kind of take away a button to use, so now you can have A to interact, B to use the sword, the C buttons to use your different items, and so on and so forth. So it, by having that automatic jumping and designing the dungeons around it, it did, you know, give them extra button to work with. Now, the game was originally slated to come out in 1997, just a year after the launch of the Nintendo 64. However, due to delays and everything, it didn't come out until, as we know, in 1998. And what's crazy is that the development team for it only started out with two members. The original two members, if I was correct in what I read here, it was Taru Osawa and I want to say Toshio Iwawaki. I apologize for butchering any of those names. Toru Osawa was the lead director for Ocarina of Time. If you want to think of like, in terms of like movie terms, he was the director of the movie. So he was in charge of everyone. He was in charge of all the different departments that would make the game. But it was a little less defined back then than it was now, because game development was still in its infancy, and it's, for the most part, it's kind of, it's not even in its infancy anymore, but it is still a relatively new thing comparatively, you know, compared to film or writing, you know, books and stuff like that, or literature, that's the word I was looking for. But they so the roles were less defined, so the team could have only been, you know, let's say the team was like 30 people. It wasn't like you're only stuck doing this. You would jump in and help where it was needed. So he did a lot of stuff, but he was known as the lead director. And he had actually ended up heading up a group of five total directors that he would help coordinate. Toshio Iwawaki was the main programming. And he was actually part of like a third party company called SRD. But the SRD is, while they didn't design the game, it's one of those companies that Nintendo would outsource to, you know, help work on stuff while they did other things. So they would send directions to the company to work on, and they would just design it in the way that Nintendo directed them to. And interestingly enough, SRD actually has like a headquarters or like an office inside of Nintendo headquarters. So they're pretty much Nintendo. They're pretty much owned by Nintendo, it seems like, even though they're considered a separate entity. But anyway, so he was the main programmer, one of the main programmers. As for Miyamoto, obviously he was the creative lead for it. He, you know, kind of headed up the project. He wasn't the lead director, but he was kind of like, if you want to think of the producer, he's the one that, you know, provided a lot of creative input and stuff like that. And Miyamoto started working, kind of like tinkering with 3D Zelda, even on the Super Nintendo. Him and someone who I haven't talked about yet, his name is Yoshiaki Koizumi. I really hope I'm not butchering any of these names, but I guess just fair warning as this episode goes on, I may butcher some more of these, if not all of them. But Koizumi and Miyamoto ended up working on kind of like a 3D remake of Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, you know, the second game on the NES. And they were originally just kind of tinkering with making a 3D side-scrolling remake for the Super Nintendo, kind of using like that, you know, like really simple polygons, like the original Star Fox and stuff. But nothing ever really came of it. But 3D Zelda was an idea even way back when. So when it finally ended up starting into development, they kind of had a little bit of a Zelda 2 influence on it. And once Super Mario 64 was done, they could add more to the team. So what started out as just those two that I mentioned before, Toshio Iwawaki and Toru Osawa, they added more to it. Koizumi ended up joining them. Another man named Takumi Kawagoe, who was in charge of camera programming. Koizumi, the guy who I mentioned before already, he was in charge of a lot of different tasks. He did environment construction. He actually designed the 3D model of Link, as well as handled like cinematic type of things. And then Eiji Aonuma, who is still with the series today, he is the lead producer for them. He is the man responsible for Breath of the Wild. He joined the project later on, though, and he ended up designing dungeons, enemy characters, boss characters, and boss battles. He also drew storyboards, but he says in the little interview I read that pretty much anyone who could draw storyboards did draw storyboards. So it wasn't just him, but... No, so like I said, it started out with just those two and ended up growing like exponentially once Mario 64 was finished. And so now that Miyamoto could focus more exclusively on Ocarina of Time and Koizumi was added into it, they kind of decided to add like some Zelda 2 like themes into it. And it kind of becomes apparent with the sword fighting style, with the combat within the game. And the combat had a lot of interesting mechanics. Well, I shouldn't say a lot. One really interesting mechanic, which was revolutionary at the time, and now, you know, players are a little bit more experienced in 3D environments, so it's not quite as necessary as it once was. And what I'm talking about is Z-targeting. Z-targeting was the combat method. So what would happen is you would hit the Z button on the N64 controller. You would target a specific enemy that your fairy, which I haven't even talked about Navi. I used her in the fucking intro and I still haven't talked about her. I try to block her out of my mind. That's why. Just don't think about her. But no. So you would target an enemy by hitting Z, and then that would help Link focus on just that enemy. So it made it easier for combat. So you didn't have to worry about, you know, where you were in relation to the enemy. You didn't have to worry about, you know, am I going to miss when I swing this sword? How am I going to swing the sword and make sure that I hit him? Z-targeting eliminated that and just let you focus on one enemy. And if you think about that, that's taking the Zelda 2D, like, side-scrolling sword fighting style and bringing it into a 3D space. And what's cool is how Z-targeting actually came about. So they were still tinkering with issues, especially with combat. They didn't know how to make combat fun because one of the things that they noticed as a problem in Mario 64, but wasn't the worst thing, was positioning on the new axis. Because, you know, normally you have an X and Y axis for 2D. Now you have the Z axis making it 3D. And how could the player make sure that they're in the right position to interact with objects? You ever play Mario 64 and it's hard to, you know, read a sign? That's what they're talking about. They knew that was an issue, but it was kind of hard to fix in Mario. You just run around in circles around the sign. You can't do that in combat, especially not in Zelda-style combat where there could be a lot of different enemies. So they needed to find a way to fix it, and they were kind of hitting a wall. And so two of the developers decided to, you know what, let's go somewhere. Let's get some inspiration. Those two developers were Koizumi and Osawa. Toru Osawa was the lead director, like I mentioned before, and Koizumi was the guy who created the character of Link, or the character model, excuse me, of Link. They decided to go to Toei Kyoto Studio Park. And Toei is a film studio. It's pretty famous in Japan. They do a lot of anime movies and stuff like that. And I'm sure some live action stuff. I'm going to be really mad at myself if they're the people that did Godzilla and I'm just like fucking it up real bad. From what I can see, it's not really looking like that. But they've done a lot of movies. Holy crap. Their most recent one, they helped with the Power Rangers remake. They worked on the Power Rangers remake in 2017, the live-action movie. Huh. They also helped with the Power Rangers show, the original Power Rangers show, as well as VR Troopers, for those who remember them, and the big bad Beetleborgs, if everyone remembers the Beetleborgs. Oh my god, there's so many of these like Super Sentai shows. Holy shit. Sorry, I went off on like a childhood tangent right there. But no, so they went to Toei Kyoto Studio Park. And like I said, the Toei Film Studios is a famous Japanese film studio, but they open up part of their studio to the public, and it serves as kind of an amusement park. And so it was very hot that day, and they decided to go cool off in the nearest show they could find, which happened to be a ninja show. And they were watching the show, and a number of ninjas surrounded the main samurai in this fight scene that was happening. One lashed out at him, and they used tried to attack the samurai with a kusarigama. I don't think I said that correctly, but what a kusarigama is, it's a sickle attached to a chain. You know, like one of those things where, think of it kind of like exactly that. It's a sickle that the end of it is attached to a chain, so you can whip it around. It's usually very hard to wield as well. But so what happens is the ninja throws this, like launches the sickle at the samurai, and the samurai catches it with his left hand with his left hand. And the chain gets stretched tight. And then they start circling each other while the chain is taut in between them. And if you kind of picture that as how Z targeting works within the 3D space of Ocarina of Time, that's it. That's exactly where it comes from. In fact, specifically, it was Toru Osawa who noticed this. Osawa noticed this. And he focused on how they interacted with each other and how the chain kind of kept them like focused on each other by, you know, they were connected to each other now. And that's what Z targeting is. It's essentially an invisible chain between Link and the enemy of the and the enemy that he's targeting. And that's where it started. Now, what Koizumi saw was just slightly different. Even though they watched the same performance, he noticed something a little different. Osawa focused on the sickle and chain, I'm not even going to try to say it again, but the sickle and chain, while Koizumi noticed, why are there so many guys and the samurai isn't dying? And what he noticed is that while the samurai was focused and fighting on one enemy, all the others waited, or they acted like they were going to attack or something like that. And they ended up implementing that into the game. If while you're targeting someone with Z-targeting, Link will get attacked less by other enemies. And you can notice it the most when you fight like the Stalfos and like other and the some of the other enemies where it's, you know, in a big room and there's two of them and you have to fight them one-on-one. And that's where Z-targeting came from. The combination of those two observations from the Toei Film Studios or the Kyoto Studio Park by Koizumi and Osawa created what we now know as Z-targeting. So, but they could end up doing more things with this. So when they implemented it, it started with just a simple little carrot, a simple little triangle to signify what the which enemy the target was. And they decided, well, that's good. That's boring. This is a Zelda game. And specifically Koizumi was like, I'm a designer. Like I'm a developer. I want to come up with a different idea. And so he decided to turn that triangle into everyone's favorite fairy, Navi. And it originally started as a fairy. It wasn't named Navi. And he just called it the Fairy Navigation System. But Osawa, the guy who was also at that show, suggested calling it Navi because she navigates. And hence where we all got Navi, you know, the ever-loving, hey, listen, that we all just, it's ingrained into our psyches from playing that game so many times. And Z-targeting was born out of that. What they could do with Navi then was do a lot of different things in terms of communicating to the player. By changing Navi's color, it could signify to the player, okay, red means enemy, blue means it's a conversation, green means it's something to investigate. And you'll notice that as you play through the game. I believe they call attention to it as well, but I honestly don't 100% remember if they call attention to the color changes. But either way, that's how it works. And I'm just scratching the surface of the little bits of information on this. So before I jump into more information, let's kind of talk about the graphics. Just something else I usually talk about on the show. There's a lot more on here, but there's, you know, we've been talking about some of the technical things for a little while now. I want to talk about something a little bit more broad. And one of the things I want to talk about are the graphics. I still think these graphics hold up really well. I think the whole world that Ocarina of Time created is very bright. It's very vivid. You always enjoy just walking around Hyrule Field. And, well, maybe not at night for those who know what I'm talking about. But it's very bright and vivid. And what was cool is that they created a day and night cycle. You know, you would have the sun would set and then the moon would come up and you could watch it all in real time. And all the different zones that you could go to, you know, you would have, you know, Death Mountain that I couldn't remember for some reason before. You would have, you know, Lake Hylia, excuse me. You would have Gerudo Valley. You would have, you know, Zora's Domain. And there was just so many different places you could go to. The Kokiri Forest, the Lost Woods, and eventually all the different temples hidden in each of those areas. Kakariko Village, which was at the base of Death Mountain. There's just so many different places, and they were also distinct and unique because the graphics were just, the art direction on it specifically was just very beautiful. It was very distinct, and each area felt different. And what's cool is that Kakariko Village at the bottom of Death Mountain, one of the big influences on the design of that village was actually the cuckoos, or the cuckoos, the chickens. The reason being is Miyamoto always thought, you know, the flying mechanic in Link to the Past, where you can, you know, use a chicken to kind of hover, was such a cool idea. But then when he's like, well, let's add this into Ocarina of Time. And then they just went hog wild with like, how cool would it be, you know, to be able to like explore more using this? Like where could a player go with this? And it makes sense because one of the parts in Ocarina of Time, you like to get to some of the hidden areas and to progress part of the game, you need to take a chicken and jump off the top of not a cliff, but like a wall, and then to float over the top of another wall in Kakariko Village. So it right there is proof that they said it in the interview, but you can see it. There's an actual implementation of it right there. And some of the other things that I always thought were like really cool was just the design of all the different weapons, you know, how they looked. I always thought the fire and light and ice arrows always looked cool, even though I know, like, I mean, visually on the screen, they didn't look that much different, but I just, the idea of it always just looked cool to me, as well as, you know, the hook shot was like, I loved all the different items you can get. And what was funny is a lot of times the game ended up enduring a lot of last minute changes, and Koizumi would always end up creating new items, and Aonuma, who was the level designer, would always have to implement them at the last minute, and he was getting so frustrated with Koizumi because he's like, why couldn't you have told me this before? Why did I have to know this now? I've already made half of these. So he would have to rebalance everything. Another thing that they would constantly be changed last minute would be the cutscenes. And Miyamoto famously does not like pre-rendered cutscenes. He does not like that because it feels like it limits him it limits his creativity. And the reason being is that once you pre-render something, to change a pre-rendered cutscene, it would take months. They would have to go back, re-render the whole thing. And a lot of times you can't, just companies won't let you do it. So he tries to design cutscenes within the game engine, so it's easier to swap things in and out. And they would have to do stuff like that all the time. He would end up saying they would create a cutscene in the game engine, and Miyamoto's like, I want this there. Link to be wearing this. I want, you know, this specific color here and this and that. And on a pre-rendered cutscene, you couldn't do that. But on the, you know, in the game software, when you could just do everything in real time, it was much more simple. Now, let's talk about, we kind of just talked a little bit about the cutscenes. We also talked about having to balance things within the dungeons. Like I said, they would add different things in there. So let's talk about the dungeons. Probably one of the most fun aspects of any Zelda game, like what are the dungeons going to be? What bosses do you have to fight? What items do you have to use in those dungeons? And the design philosophy for this game stole heavily from Link to the Past for the Super Nintendo. Basically, you know, where you get a new item in each dungeon, you use that item generally to defeat the boss of that dungeon, though in Link to the Past, it wasn't always the case. In Ocarina of Time, you pretty much had to, it was pretty much every dungeon you were in, you beat the boss with the weapon you got in that dungeon. And that would be the formula for Zelda games for a long, long time, for almost 20 years, in fact, 19 years until Breath of the Wild broke the cycle. And actually, I guess you could say a Link Between Worlds kind of broke the cycle as well, but we're not talking about either of those games today. But no, so you would, a lot of the dungeons were just super memorable between Dodongo's Cavern, between Jabu Jabu's Belly, as well as the Forest Temple. My least favorite personally was the Shadow Temple because it scared the shit out of me as a kid. I don't know why I didn't put that in my horror things. I thought that was too obvious, I guess. You know, the episode I did of top 10 scary moments in non-horror games. The whole Shadow Temple could have been one, but I always, like, I remember the Wall Masters, which was on that list specifically from both the Forest Temple and the Shadow Temple. And for some reason, the Forest Temple just scared me a little bit more because I was expecting it to be kind of like happy and not happy, but like a little bit more bright. It was very creepy in the Forest Temple. But all the temples were really unique and they all had really fun mechanics that they would offer. I did like in the Forest Temple, especially the Phantom Ganon fight in the Forest Temple, which just kind of do a little bit of a callback to what I was saying before, how Miyamoto wanted the whole thing to be in Ganon's castle originally. That boss fight with Phantom Ganon in the Forest Temple was kind of like a really primitive, like toned down version of that, where, you know, you have all those different paintings and Ganon runs in and out of them. Hopefully it wasn't going to do that, like I said, for like seriously, because that would have been very just Mario 64 with Zelda. But anyway, I always liked the Phantom Ganon fight, how you had to like keep an eye out and always look, you know, keep spinning around to see which painting he was going to come out of next. I also like the, I can't remember the boss's name, but the boss from the Fire Temple, where it was that like that giant dragon that was coming out of the ground. You had to use the Megaton Hammer to hit him and break his armor. And of course, the fucking Water Temple. No one, I know so few people who like the Water Temple. The boss fight I actually thought was really fun, how you would use the hook shots, you know, pull off the different parts of him and then slash him, and you have to, you know, rinse, wash, repeat until he was done. One of my other least favorite parts of the design of the game is how they would add the mini temples in between, like the ice cavern and stuff like that. I always hated that. I just wanted to go to the next main temple and, you know, solve the puzzles and fight the bosses. But it just irked me that they had those in there. I don't know. I especially the ice cavern or whatever it was, because everything was so slippery and they had those circling like spikes that would just constantly, you couldn't stop in time and you'd always get hit by them off. It pissed me off. I hate those things. And overall, just every, like the game was designed really well. And what was cool is that, like I mentioned before, with the young and old Link, there were mechanics they added in because of that time change. Like as a young Link, you could plant a seed, and when you would fast forward to adult Link, now it was a little flower that would, you know, float you up to different spots and could get you to places that you normally could not have gotten. And that was always really cool to me. I mean, I was too lazy to deal with it half the time, but it was always really cool. I also really liked all the side quests in the game, especially getting like the Bigoron sword, the Big Goron. Is it the Big Goron sword or is it the Bigoron sword? I don't know. It's that giant sword at the top of Death Mountain where the giant Goron makes it, and you have to follow a whole chain of quests to like get different items and trade them around, a big trade chain. It's obnoxious, but when you finally get it, it's a really awesome sword, even though a young Link can't even use it, and adult Link can barely swing the damn thing. But anyway, probably my favorite mechanic in the whole game is Epona. And who wouldn't want to? I mean, I remember when I first got Epona, the horse, for those who don't know, and you would start riding her around Hyrule Field. It blew my freaking little whatever 10-year-old mind. I forget how old I was when I first played it. I wasn't quite 10. I want to say 13 or 14, but when I first played it, and I couldn't get enough of it. It was so much fun to ride around. And the team planned to let you do horseback fighting, kind of like sword fighting. The Miyamoto wanted that specifically. They ended up only putting an archery thing in, which Miyamoto also wanted. So he got the horseback archery, but not the horseback fighting, which I think would have been a little tedious, in my opinion. But Epona was just such an awesome addition. It was just a lot of fun to ride. And she was actually something they wanted in the game early. And the name Epona, they named her Epona because it comes from the name, it's a Celtic god. Epona is a Celtic god. That's a name. And Epona is a Celtic god of horses and fertility. And it's a weird combination. I don't know what the Celts were up to. Just saying, horses, fertility. Not my favorite, but when they added her in, Miyamoto was like, that just doesn't feel game-like enough. So that's why they added that little carrot system in, the little sprint system in, and to make it more game-like. But in any case, I always thought Opponent was just such a really cool addition. And I guess that kind of closes out my thoughts on the design. And to kind of wrap up some of the more technical things before I go into a little bit of a nostalgia trip, the last type of little like fun facts I'll give is that the game, when it was started out in development, it was originally intended to be released for the Nintendo 64 disk drive, or the DD. For those who don't know what the disk drive is, I think I talked about it on my gimmicks episode like a while ago, but the disk drive was going to be a CD-based add-on for the Nintendo 64, and it did end up getting released, but only in Japan. It was never released outside of there. It allowed players to go online with this thing called RANNet, which is like a subscription-based online service. It had a handful of games released, I talked a little bit about it last week with the Nintendo 64 retrospective. But thankfully they didn't do that. Well, at least the developers are very thankful they did not put the game on the disk drive, because it would have been harder in terms of memory. While the game could have stored more, since it wasn't ROM or like flash memory, it would have been more difficult to do certain programming things. For example, Link had a lot of different animations, and on ROM, ROM cartridges like the N64 had, it wasn't a hard thing to do because it could just grab it immediately. But on a disc medium, it would have actually had to move the laser to different spots to get all the different necessary animations for that Link to move. So to make the game run smoothly, they would have had to cut down on the possible animations. I believe what I read was that Link had 500 unique animations throughout the course of the game, and if it would have been on a disk drive, they wouldn't have been able to include as many as they did. So that's where I think that's kind of interesting. I find that interesting that they didn't want the larger discs, the larger size. And I guess there are benefits to the cartridges. And like I said in the last episode, in retrospect, cartridges are a pretty nice thing because it's fast, but it did also limit them severely in space. But it still blows my mind what they were able to accomplish with the minimal amount of space on a cartridge. They put Ocarina of Time into a 32 meg cartridge, and that I still can't believe that. That it's for how big that game is. I'm amazed they put all of that on such a small amount of space, considering Final Fantasy VII took 3 700 meg discs, and like Final Fantasy 8 and 9 were 4 discs long each. Like, that's crazy. Granted, they had a lot of pre-rendered cutscenes, but it's still nuts to me. But all right, so let's start to wrap this up. What I want to close with is I'll kind of combo these two because they kind of hit the same button for me. Music and nostalgia. The music's fantastic. I'm not a musician. I don't know music theory, so I wish I could comment more on it. If you guys really want to like learn more about the music theory of Zelda games and just of video game music in general, go check out the Super Mercado Bros podcast. That's Super, and then Mercado is MARCATO. Mercado Bros, like Mario Bros, but Mercado Bros podcast. They don't know me at all, but I really have been enjoying their podcast, and they break down from a like a musical standpoint, like an actual musician standpoint, why this music's great. And they cover a variety of different topics, but anyway, that's a little plug for them, even though they don't know me at all. But it's still a great podcast, so go check it out. But no, the music in this game is just timeless. It still holds up. It's still great. Like you can hum, you know, like the between even like small themes like the shop theme. And like the individual characters' themes that are like kind of like one-offs. Like I know Saria has a pretty big theme, but or a pretty big part in the story. But relatively speaking, compared to everything else, she's kind of a little one-off character, and her theme's still really catchy. She plays a bigger part. She's one of the sages. It's been so long since I've completely played this. Her theme's really catchy. Just the game in general. I love. The music in this, I played so much of this as a kid, and this is why I was wanting to tie this into nostalgia, that as soon as I hear the music, it just takes me back to where I was like a 13-year-old kid or 12 or 13 years old and just sitting on the couch in my living room just playing this game. And I remember getting stuck in the very beginning of the game. I didn't understand where to go. I couldn't get past Mido or whatever his face is, the guy that won't let you pass unless you have a sword and shield. I could get the shield, but I didn't know where the sword was. And the game does, like, it kind of directs you to it, but I didn't see there's a hole in the wall for you to crawl in. And I remember there's a friend of mine that I emailed back and forth. That was the first email address I had, was in like sixth grade. I also was a little older to be playing this because the game had already been out for a number of years. But unfortunately, this friend of mine, his name was Mike. There's a lot of Mikes I know. My brother Mike, the Mike from last week, the Mike from the Manhunt episode. There's just so many Mikes. But unfortunately, the Mike that I'm talking about, he passed away when I was pretty young. And I'm not trying to bring everyone down, but I think it's why this game's so important to me, because I actually still have the email conversations with him of him helping me trying to like figure this out. I would email him with getting stuck on things. He actually let me borrow his strategy guide, which I never actually gave back because I still have it. And I don't think his family, I don't know. I have to reconnect with his family. I don't even know if I don't know if I still have it, but I'm pretty sure he let me borrow his strategy. I should see if they'd want it still, but in any case, he would email me back and forth. I remember vividly the one time I was stuck in Dodongo's cavern, and you fight like the baby Dodongos, and I could not figure out how to beat them. And the game scared me so much as a kid, and the fact they were breathing fire at me, and I didn't know what to do. And I remember he told me just run up to them, and when they start breathing fire, run around behind them and slash them in the tail. I'm like, the tail? You gotta hit him in the tail? I thought that was just so strange, and when I did it, it was great. I still have those emails, and this game will always make me smile because of those memories. Even though I mean, I haven't seen him in over 15 years. Obviously, he passed away a good while ago. Not quite 20 years. It would be. Let me think. It was about 17 years ago, and I'll never forget it. I mean, this game means a lot to me because of that, and because of everything that the game's, you know, is a part of. Like, it just sticks with you when you first play it. I don't think kids playing it now will have the same effect because they're so used to modern games, but Zelda kind of has that effect on people in general. People who like Zelda remember their first Zelda game forever, whether it's a good Zelda game or not. Like, I know some people will even say like Ocarina of Time may not be the greatest one, but it is one of the most important ones. And like I said in the 64 episode last week, the reason it's probably one of the most important ones is because it taught people how to design games in 3D. No one knew what they were doing with that. And this game's just super important to me. I don't think I'll ever really, even if I may not enjoy playing it as much as I used to because I overplayed it so much as a kid, which unfortunately is now, but it still will mean the same amount to me. Even if I don't have the same level of enjoyment playing it over and over again, it'll still mean the same to me because it was just so, and it was so vital to me as a kid, just like being able to explore this world and like learning about all the different people. And I remember I used to take the strategy guide to my church, and I would just pour over the map and just stare at him like, what would it be like to go to Hyrule Castle? What would it be like to go to Lake Hylia and like meet Zoras and stuff like that? It captured my imagination in a way no game had up until that point, and very few games have since that point. Now that I'm a cynical adult, it's even harder for games to really capture my imagination like that. But no, if, for those who have not played this game, I really, seriously, go try it. I mean, I'd be surprised if you've listened in this far and have not at least tried the game or at least played a little bit of it. But seriously, go give it a listen. It still holds up. It's still a lot of fun. And I can't really recommend it enough. And I think that, yeah, it just go and try it. And so that about wraps it up for me today, guys. Based off what I'm seeing here, I'm probably gonna have to cut out a good chunk still because I had a couple mishaps, but this is going to be a long one, and I'm amazed I've been able to talk to myself for like 54 or 55 minutes. And I originally had a bunch of guests lined up for this, but unfortunately everyone fell through last minute and I didn't really have time to get new guests in the last, you know, I had guests lined up 2 weeks in advance and it just all kind of fell apart, unfortunately. So now I have to record this all a week in advance. I'm actually recording this a couple days before the anniversary of Ocarina of Time, but no, so seriously, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for listening to me ramble for almost an hour. I hope everything was pretty intelligible and it made sense. I try to keep some segues in there and try to make it make sense. If you guys have any suggestions on how to make episodes like this a little bit more cohesive, just let me know. You can follow me at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you also want to reach out to me via email, you can reach out to me at StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. Also, once again, shout outs to the Podbeer Network. Two Guys in a Game, The Hotter Show, Creeper Sleep, Dark Runner Gaming on Twitch, Honestly Lazy Show on YouTube, Mics and Beers, another great podcast. Shout outs to all them great guys, great content creators. So go give them a listen, a like, a follow, watch their stuff. They're all great. Also, check out some of my friends, Erica from the Apex in the Abyss, one of my good friends from the area. She does an amazing true crime podcast. Go check her out. Also check out my friends from the No Geeks Allowed podcast. That's KNOW, No Geeks Allowed. Another really great geek podcast, and they're funny as hell. Go give them a listen too. Also check out the Drinks with Larry podcast. Really fucking funny podcast. Bunch of comedians just goofing around, like ragging on each other. Great times. The Amazing Nerd Show, really good. They cover a lot of comics and wrestling and horror movies. They're really knowledgeable and they can go long. If you want a long podcast, give these guys a listen. I'm impressed how much they're able to, like, I wish I could be as insightful as they are in order to, just provide as much content as they do. They're so insightful in everything they cover. So seriously, give them a listen. And I know I'm forgetting someone. Oh, I already mentioned him before, but the Super Mercado Bros, once again, they don't know me at all, but I really like their podcast. So I want to give them a shout out. Same with Singing Mountain. Drew Mackey is the host of that. It's a video game music podcast, and he's been, liking and retweeting some of the stuff that I tag him in. So shout out to him. His podcast is really good. It's what kind of got me into the video game music podcast, not scene, but just enjoyed listening to them. And lastly, a shout out to a podcast I've been listening to a lot, The Frame Savers, which is a video game speedrunning podcast. In fact, I'd have to check, but I would not be surprised if they did an episode on Ocarina of Time and about the speedrun for it. I didn't really touch on it in this episode, but when you get a chance, sit down and treat yourself to an Ocarina of Time speedrun. You can just look up Games Done Quick on YouTube. It's easy to find. And it will blow your fucking mind. I'm dead serious. It is insane what the speedrunners do to this game. They break it in so many different ways. It's one of the most impressive things I've ever watched. And yeah, I think that's it for my shout outs. So thank you all once again for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Please remember to rate, review, and to subscribe if for those who are listening for the first time. Rate and review anyone, please. Just helps get the word out, helps get me known on iTunes, as well as gives me some feedback to let me know what I can improve on, or if I'm liking it, I can keep doing more of what you guys like. Yeah, so that should be it. So thank you all once again for listening, and I will see you all next time.